It's been more than a year since President Donald Trump announced the travel ban that prohibits immigrants from certain countries from coming to the United States. In addition to that policy change, the Trump administration placed a cap on the number of refugees the country is willing to accept, limiting it to 45,000 for fiscal year 2018, down from 50,000 in 2017 and 85,000 in 2016. Meanwhile, war, famine, drug and gang violence, and even drought have created a global refugee crisis. This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means. Utah has been a pretty friendly state to refugees. After Trump's policy announcement, Governor Gary Herbert made clear that Utah would continue to be a welcoming place for them, though since it's national policy, he can't take in more than they send him. But while Utah appears willing to open its doors to those fleeing their countries of origin, it seems that Trump's policy has substantially affected who is coming in to make a home in the Beehive State. I asked Aidan Batar, Director of Migration and Refugee Services for Catholic Community Services, about the numbers on refugees coming through the organization and how they compare to those in years past.
If I take a minute to explain about the refugee that were coming to the state of Utah. Historically, we were resettling about 1,200 refugees up until fiscal year 2016. So when President Trump came to office in 2017, the refugee numbers, were reduced. From fiscal year 2016, we had 85,000 refugees arrive in the U.S. Fiscal year 17, even though President Obama, before he left the office, increased the refugee number admission from 85,000 to 110,000, we only ended up 50,000 refugees arrived fiscal year 2017. Now we are in fiscal year 2018. We have seen a lot of series of executive orders limiting the refugee numbers and also what we call it travel ban or Muslim ban, whatever you call it. Reduce the refugee numbers. The president's at first time in the history of the refugee program, he reduced the numbers to 45,000. But the way things are going right now, I don't think we are going to achieve that goal of 45,000. We're lucky if we receive 20,000 refugees this fiscal year.
That's significantly lower.
Very, very lower. Throughout the history of the program, I've been working for this program for more than 20 years. I have not seen a reduction in refugee numbers to this low. Even when 9/11 happened, our numbers were not low like this. So in Utah, as I say earlier, we were resettling 1,200 refugees. This year, as of to date, we are in May, we have received only 135 refugees arrive. If I can show you some comparison, previous years around this time, last year around this time, we had 344 refugees arrived. Fiscal year 2016, around this time, we had 389. And that you can see that we are not even close to half of that number, and we are already surpassed 6 months. We are in the seventh month of the fiscal year. I don't think we're going to achieve 300 refugees this year for Catholic Community Services. Mm-hmm. I think between IRC and Catholic Community Services, historically, we were resettling over 1,200 refugees a year.
We, of course, brought up the travel ban put into place by the Trump administration, but can you talk about the process a little bit more? Are the same number of refugees still applying to enter into the United States, or have they been turned off by the attitude here in the U.S.?
So the refugee numbers worldwide has hit a record that we haven't seen since World War II. The refugees that are in the refugee camps that are registered with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees are over 22 million as we speak today. And about 65 million people have been forcibly displaced by civil war, political unrest, and so forth. Of those, about the 22 that I mentioned are ended up in the refugee camp. The rest are trapped in their home countries, and we call it, internally displaced people. So you can see the level of refugees are increasing. Of the 22 million, you know, the majority of them are from three countries, you know, Syria, Afghanistan, and, you know, Somalia, and I will say Congo are the majority of those refugees. And I think if we, you know, keep them in the refugee camp and we don't allow them to be resettled, those refugees would not have anywhere to go back to. They simply will be warehoused in the refugee camps. So I think every year the international community, you know, refers at least about 200 refugees for resettlement opportunities. And the U.S. was taking the largest number of that 200. I mean, historically, the United States were accepting 75,000. If this year we only bring 20,000, you know, what's going to happen the rest? I don't think any other country will take the majority of the refugees. They will be staying in the refugee camp, don't have any hope for their future. But we have the will, we have the resources, we have the capacity to resettle in Utah 1,200 refugees or more if the government allow us to resettle. But we are not being given that opportunity, unfortunately.
Can you talk about some of the services that resettlement agencies provide for refugees in Utah?
So refugees, when they arrive in Utah, there are two organizations that helps them, Catholic Community Services and International Rescue Committee. There's also another third organization, Asian Association of Utah, who also helps second migrant refugees. So within our organizations, there is a variety of services that we provide. The services include case management that we provide for up to 2 years. We do employment services, health services, mental health services, education services, and specialized case management services. At Catholic Community Services, we also provide immigration services for our refugees and anyone who is in need of immigration. We also have a refugee foster care program. We bring and accompany refugee minors, and we place them into foster homes. And so all these services, you know, is geared toward helping the refugees successfully integrate into our community by removing any barrier that comes on their way. Within 6 months of refugees being in Utah, they become self-sufficient, they get jobs, they provide to their families, they take care of their bills, they do not depend on our public benefits. They just need the initial hand up. The refugees are not looking for handouts. So they just need to be given an opportunity. They're looking for jobs from day one, and they start working immediately after arrival.
Well, let's talk about those organizations that have the ability to resettle refugees. And Reuters reported earlier this year that the diminished number of refugees entering the country will probably result in the closing of agencies around the United States. How has this diminished number affected refugee resettlement agencies in Utah?
When the executive order came out and reduced the number of refugee arrivals, we had to let a lot of staff go because we could not operate the program with less refugee arrivals. So all our agencies lost a lot of staff that we couldn't keep. And we had to cut all the expenses that we could. Right now, we are to the bottom that we did cut whatever we could. And unless we're going to close our agencies, that's the only thing that is left for us. Earlier this year, the State Department asked our national agencies. There are about 9 voluntary agencies in the United States that resettle refugees. The State Department, which funds the refugee resettlement program, asked those 9 voluntary agencies to close any of their offices that were resettling 100 refugees or less. Within our Catholic network alone, over a dozen offices were closed. Because of that, you know, the State Department say that they will not fund. So now I think the issue is that, you know, we have been building capacity for more than 40 years. And this program has been working very successfully. And over the last 40 years, we saved more than 3 million lives. We resettled 3 million refugees in the United States. And And these individuals and families that we resettle over the years are part of our community today. They're contributing members of our society. They work so hard. They are our neighbors. They are our brothers and sisters that need our help.
You mentioned that in 6 months, refugees are, for the most part, self-sufficient. How would the closure of resettlement agencies, Catholic Community Services, IRC, how would it affect the integration of the refugees?
So if the agencies that are helping the refugees are not there for the refugees, it is going to be impossible for the refugees to receive the services, this vital services that would help them, their integration into our community. There's right now, just the Catholic Community Services, we have over 250 families that we are case managing for 2 years. We have over 80 unaccompanied refugee children in our care. Where will they go? I mean, who's going to take care of their needs if our agencies are not being given the resources that we need to provide those valuable services? We have, you know, thousands of immigrants that are coming to our offices seeking immigration help. And, you know, many of them have relatives who are U.S. citizens or have permanent residency that they are looking into ways to get their legal status. If we're not there for them, no one else will. We'll help them. I think the services that we are providing to the immigrants and refugees, you know, saves millions of dollars for our community. And also, and it's the right thing to do because we are helping human beings who need our help. And brothers and they are our brothers and sisters. And if we don't step up for them, no one else will. We are their voice. We are there to protect their rights. We are here to help them integrate into our society. I think this is, you know, this is shameless, you know, that we're not being given this opportunity to continue the work that we do. It is really, you know, not who we are as an American by not opening our doors to those that need our help.
All right, I think that's a great place to end. Aidan Batar from Catholic Community Services, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Another organization that's providing support to refugees living here now is Women of the World. The nonprofit organization celebrated Mother's Day this year with a potluck, flowers and dancing. And they also acknowledged one woman in particular, Razan, a woman from Syria who left her country with her husband and 5 children. I asked Executive Director Samira Harnish to talk about why she chose Razan as Mother of the Year.
I met Razan and her husband 2 years ago when they came in the first time into Utah. And they said, oh, we heard about Women of the World when we were in Syria. And because they have some friends in here, they talked to them about it. Of course, you know, he introduced me to his 3 kids. They are disabled. You know, they have 5 kids, but 3 of them, they, you know, I think it's a gene, you know, when they born disabled. So the 2 oldest is 21, I think, and the other one is 18. And the youngest one is 5 years, the one she is on the wheelchair. So they said, can you help us to get them in the school? I know there is a school for the disabled in here, but they don't have it in Syria. Even if they do have it in Syria, actually, but they cannot afford it. And he is a chef and she is sitting home, take care of her kids. Of course, she quit from school just to be with her kids. And she works really hard, you know, to take care of them. And the war, 2011, and running away from the war and make her kids safe. It took so much energy and so much sacrifice and so much sadness until she get in here. And when she came in here, of course, she loved it so much. It's because there's school. They can take care of her kids if they have money or they don't have money. And she was really kind of very surprised. She said, her husband and her, they said, Utah is like our father and our mother took us, you know, with a big hug. And you know, took care of my kids. They weren't a human being when they were in Syria, so they felt it's like they count them as a human being. They take care of them and all these things. You know.
I'm familiar with Women of the World because I produce their podcast for them. Harnish says the organization works to help women achieve self-sufficiency through programs such as English tutoring and connecting them with employment opportunities. But given a few cultural differences, refugee mothers often face some specific challenges when they come to the United States.
Well, I mean, of course, the mother back home in a lot of countries, actually, always they're the one there taking care of the children, and the husband goes to work. Even though if she has a degree, you know, the mother and go to work, when she comes home, of course, she knows she has to do cook and clean and be sure the kids, if they've been eaten and healthy and having homework, she helped them with that. I would say it's like one of the things is, you know, of course, when they see it is really harder to come over here. If they weren't working in their country and they're either part-time, they were working or, you know, not working, even though if they are a doctor or engineer, it's because they have kids, they have to take care of them, and because the husband is the one bringing the money and all these things. Because it's kind of, some of the men, they see it kind of shame for the woman, the wife, if she works when they are in their country. So they don't want the woman to work. They tell her to sit home and take care of the kids and the house. So when they come over here, unfortunately, they kind of shock is because they see the husband is working, but is not bringing the enough money for the house, you know, because they have to restart their living. I mean, they start from zero, you know. So if the husband is not speaking really good English, right, and he's an engineer or, you know, have a degree, they cannot practice the engineering in here. They have to certify their major in here in America. So they work like a simple job, like in Walmart, hotels and everything. So the woman, she will say, oh, wow, now is my turn. I have to work, you know, to help those children. So if they were knowing how to speak English, of course, they will find something is like maybe a better in companies or whatever, pay them more than $10. Or if they don't, you know, speaking English, you see them, they are working really hard, you know, for $10. Right. So the woman is leaving the house and the kids, they come from the school and there's no mom and dad around, you know, to help them around. So this is really kind of, you know, a new life for them.
I spoke with one mother, Layla, at the Mother's Day celebration. She and her husband have two young sons. She takes care of the boys. They play at the park and ride bikes. Layla described her experience as a mother from a different country.
My name is Layla. I'm from Morocco. I have been in Utah 5 years ago. To be a mother is not easy. It's a very big responsibility. And a lot of happiness, a lot of tired. In my country, I think will be easier because of my family will help me. I have family, I have, you know, the same culture. But here, we don't have nobody here. No family, only my husband. It's very, very big responsibility and very hard here to be a mother.
Mother's Day isn't a globally recognized holiday. And for some refugees, especially those who are newly resettled, it's just another unusual custom that they're trying to get a better grasp on. That struggle to understand is part of the process of integrating into a new culture. During a recent interview with National Public Radio, White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly brought up the topic of integration when he made this statement regarding immigrants crossing the border illegally.
But they are also not people that would easily assimilate into the United States, into our modern society. They're overwhelmingly rural people. In the countries they come from, fourth, fifth, sixth grade educations are kind of the norm. They don't speak English, obviously. That's a big thing. They don't speak English. They don't integrate well. They don't have skills.
Karen Frost has a different perspective on the process of refugees and immigrants becoming part of their host community. She's the director of the Center for Research on Migration and Refugee Integration at the University of Utah. And she thinks a lot about facilitating a smooth transition for refugees and the countries that host them. And for this process, the words matter.
So the term that comes out of the White House, which is sort of, I would say, in about the last year, is the term assimilation. But what we really think about is integration. Okay, so let's go ahead and define assimilation. Sure. Okay, so assimilation is really, if we think about it, it's the process of adapting or adjusting to the culture of a group or nation or a state of being so adapted. But the idea really is that the newcomer, the people coming in, would be assimilating and giving up everything about their own culture.
And completely taking on whatever it means to be American.
Right. Taking on the mainstream, dominant, whatever term that you want to use there, all of their values and all of the things that they do. So it would be only speaking English. It would be only being Christian. It would be only being certain kinds of things. This term has a particularly negative and colonialist connotation. So we really don't want to promote that. If we think about assimilation, we think about what happened with American Indian groups in past centuries and to a certain degree what happens now, that we expect them to accept and use middle-class white values for how they're going to do things, which means they're denying everything about their own identities and their own cultural heritage, which is really, really unfortunate.
And in some cases, their history, I guess, if we're talking about Native people having gone to school, and the historical narrative is much different from what their ancestors experienced.
Exactly. And, you know, when we think about the United States, for better or worse, the United States is really built on people coming in from other countries and bringing new ideas. That's how come we're so innovative about things, that we have new ways of doing and new ways of seeing things, because we're coming from different places, right? So if we can capitalize on those worldviews, and I realize capitalize is probably not the best term, but build on those different worldviews, we are always a much better country for that. So the term assimilation is not one that we, with the people with whom I work and our community partners, that we really support.
So you prefer to use integration, which looks a little bit different from assimilation.
Yeah, so integration is really about how you think about the individual and the environment being connected. It's also about the bringing of people of different racial and ethnic groups in unrestricted and equal association, okay? So it's really about how you bring people together in safe and equal spaces so that people can talk about what they think about things. And that's what's important about integration. So if we think about getting people to integrate, not only does the new incoming group need to integrate, the host community needs to integrate as well, which means that you are developing acceptance and understanding about different cultural values, different cultural ideas, as well as thinking about, okay, different languages are good. Different languages give you a different way of looking at the world. And wouldn't we all want to be at least bilingual, maybe multilingual? I mean, it's a very positive thing. There is always a problem with, as people are working toward integrating, that for some people it's difficult to learn to speak English. When you're an older adult and you are learning to speak another language, that's always much harder than if you're learning to speak it when you're much younger. So we know that for some of the older refugee and immigrant individuals who either may not be literate in their own language, it's much harder to learn English. But it isn't that they don't want to, because they're all taking English classes. They're all working on these kinds of things. So I think John Kelly's ideas are, I would say, they're colonialist and dated about where we are now in the United States.
So you pointed out, you know, how much more difficult it is to learn a language when you're older. Is the process of integrating into society, into a community, is it something that happens throughout generations of a family, or can someone just come in from their country of origin, come into the U.S. and, you know, be part of the community?
Mm-hmm. So it can happen in one generation. Okay, so people coming in, they can integrate, and they do want to integrate. I mean, when you talk to people from the refugee communities, they do want to do this because they know they're going to be here. Okay, so they want this for themselves, and they want this for their children. Integration is really a two-way process. Okay, it can't just be that we expect people who are new to do all of the integrating. Okay, we can't expect them to give up everything about their own cultural identity and cultural heritage, but at the same time, we can't expect them to take on everything from what we consider American mainstream middle class ideas. Somewhere in the middle, that's where people are mentally healthier, where you are allowed or you can keep your own cultural identity, pieces of it that you really, really find valuable. If you are expected to give everything up, the research does indicate that people are less mentally healthy if you give everything up. Okay, and if people force you to give everything up, that's never a good thing, because what does it say about your own sense of you, right? Yeah. So integration really should be an intentional two-way process where people coming in are allowed or supported in asking questions and finding out what is of value to them from the new cultural group. And then the host culture also should be figuring out how to more effectively integrate with newcomers. So it should be an exchange of ideas rather than my way is best and you need to do what I think is best.
So this is something you've been working on with the center, doing research on this topic. Can you point to different effects, more effects of integrating or being forced to assimilate?
I think that we would like to, from the center's perspective, focus on strengths rather than deficits, okay? A lot of what we see in the news is deficits, like what John Kelly said, you know, they have no skills, they're from rural areas, they don't speak English. They do have skills. Everybody has skills. And what we see is that immigrants and refugees who come to the United States tend to be people who have they're physically healthier, they're more mentally healthy, they really want to be here, so they're going to want to develop more skills to stay. So there are 10 indicators of integration, okay? And the first four, the most basic ones, are that, you know, you have healthcare, you have employment, you have housing, and you can have access to education, all right? If those four basic things are provided to people, people will build on those. The second set of things that we are concerned about are about how we make sure that people are still attached to others from their home community. Okay.
Which I imagine can be really difficult if you're a refugee, especially.
It can be. Our resettlement agencies do a really wonderful job of putting people, some people together from same communities where they're housed in close proximity. And then at the Office of Refugee Services, at their Refugee Education and Training Center, they do a lot of courses and classes where they pull in leadership from the various refugee communities and have them work together and get them to think about how can you best support your community. So they've done a wonderful job of making sure that there are still those social bonds and social bridges that we are thinking about. And at the same time, then we have the International Rescue Committee, Catholic Community Services, and Asian Association of Utah, who also work to make sure that people have access to different resources. And these are the social links that we need to have in order to make our lives whole. And we all have to have those social links, right? Whether you're accessing healthcare or radio, public radio is a social link, right? So how do you get your information? How do you use it? How is it provided to you? And then we think about things like language acquisition, okay? And then also about safety. Are you safe? Are you stable? That kind of thing in the places that you live. And the final, probably the pinnacle of being integrated really is about civic engagement. So are you running for office? I mean, you know, this is important. And if you think about most people in what we call the host or receiving communities, people like you and me, do we run for office? And are we having a separate expectation for people who are newly arriving? So where do we fit in all of this, too? And I think it's a work in progress for everybody.
So these are some of the steps that it takes to become a self-sustaining individual.
Yes, to be integrated, fully integrated into your new society. Yes.
Karen Frost, Director of the Center for Research on Migration and Refugee Integration at the University of Utah. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Emily. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in.
You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org, and you can connect with us on Facebook at kcpw88.3. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.